The GI Research Foundation was able to produce this podcast with a generous sponsorship from Metro Infusion Centers.
Hi, and welcome to Visceral, a podcast from the GI Research Foundation. Today we're kicking off a two-part series, The 10 Critical Challenges Facing IBD Patients and Providers. In this episode, part one, we'll dig into the first five challenges. Part two is coming your way in September 2025. So hit subscribe and you'll be the first to know when it's out. Now, here's our host, Anna Gomberg.
Today, we have a very special guest, one of my most favorite people, Dr. David Rubin. Dr. Rubin is the Joseph B. Kirzner Professor of Medicine and Chief of the Section of Gastroenterology, Hepatology, and Nutrition at the University of Chicago Medicine, where he also serves as the Director of the Inflammatory Bowel Disease Center. He was recently elected the chair of the International Organization for the Study of Inflammatory Bowel Disease, IOIBD, an organization whose mission is to promote the health of people with IBD worldwide by setting the direction for patient care, education, and research. And we are so fortunate to have Dr. Rubin with us today. He's going to lead us through something that experts in IBD everywhere talk about all the time, addressing the state of inflammatory bowel disease right here, right now, and the top 10 challenges faced by healthcare providers, researchers, and patients living with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis. Welcome, Dr. Rubin. We are so glad that you are here, and we cannot wait to hear what you have to share with us.
Well, hi, Annie. Thank you for having me, and I want to thank the Gastrointestinal Research Foundation for hosting this really important discussion. I have been thinking a lot about where we are in the world of IBD. I've been doing this for a while now, as you know, and I've had the privilege to gain some perspective on both the progress we've made, which is considerable, and the additional work we have left to do, which is also considerable. I was asked at a meeting in Paris recently to speak to the challenges in IBD. And that was all the instruction I was given, was just the title. And it was a wonderful title because it stimulated me to organize my thoughts into what I think are the 10 challenges facing us in inflammatory bowel disease at the end of 2025 and moving into 2026. And I appreciate the opportunity to share an updated version of that for your listeners and for all those out there who are motivated and understand some of this. I encourage you to continue the hard work that we have left in front of us and to continue supporting the organizations like the GI Research Foundation that are working to solve these challenges. So let's get right into it. The first challenge on my list of 10 is that we haven't cured IBD yet. What sounds like an obvious challenge, but also one that's incredibly complex. The recognition that we haven't cured IBD is, of course, very obvious, but often it gets left behind when we're talking about all of our new therapies. But we know that this is the ultimate goal, is understanding both the causes, plural, and cures for the inflammatory bowel diseases. And what we call Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis currently, we recognize and have recognized are really more like 20 or 30 different conditions. The body only has a certain way of expressing itself. So anything that results in chronic or long-term inflammation that can cause damage will look somewhat similarly. And we classify diseases into their different names in order to understand prognosis, in order to develop treatments. But getting back to the origin story, we want to understand why is it happening in the first place? And when we understand that, we can then work to eradicate the disease, or to use the term, cure it. And cure is defined in different ways, but for most people and those listening, I suspect it has some similar features. It means the disease is no longer present in the way it affects the individual. It means the individual does not require any medical therapy or other treatments to manage it. And of course, it also means that it's durable, that it doesn't come back, that it is gone in these ways over some period of time. In cancer, of course, the term cure is usually applied to no evidence of disease after 5 years. But we now even accept that some cancers are treated chronically as opposed to trying for just cure. So as we think about why we haven't cured IBD, it becomes a bit more obvious that it's complicated, that it actually is many more diseases than the two that we usually classify it as, and that we have a lot more work to do to figure some of this out. The good news is that we've made progress in this regard. We are breaking down the IBDs into many different components. There have been tremendous discoveries, including the first gene for Crohn's at the University of Chicago in 2001, which was funded by the GI Research Foundation, that work. And of course, over 300 subsequent genetic associations. But very importantly, and I think key to this, is the recognition that there are environmental shifts that seem to be contributing to much of this. If you ask patients or family members about IBD, they often will point to the environment. And in that way, I mean stress, diet, where they're living. And we're looking at those trends globally, which is another challenge I'll talk about in a minute. Now, to address this, there's many people working very hard, but one of the organizations that's working hard is the one you included in your introduction. I'm really honored to chair the International Organization for the Study of IBD, IOIBD. And over the next 3 years, when I'm doing that, and I expect subsequently, we are working to reclassify the IBDs and to do so first in a clinical manner that makes sense. So we're going to take the diseases apart and not think of them as Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis as much as inflammation of the large intestine or the small intestine, and then look even at a molecular level to try to piece together different ways of characterizing these diseases, and then have more information that will gain understanding of why certain treatments work or don't. And we expect will also, of course, help us look for causes, develop cures, and have new strategies for prevention, which is a huge one, and we'll come to that as well. So the next challenge, number 2 of 10, is that inflammatory bowel disease has really become a global disease. And this may be more obvious to some of our listeners, but it didn't happen overnight. In the older days, IBD was acknowledged as a disease of the Western world, a disease of the industrialized nations. In some analyses, a disease of the Northern Hemisphere. And there were all these observations that suggested this wasn't something you would see in other parts of the world, in other places where they were more rural than urban or less industrialized. But in fact, everywhere you look now across the world, you can find inflammatory bowel disease. And this is not just an observational bias because we have more technology. It actually is related to true global epidemiologic shifts with rising IBD incidences, that means new cases in a set population, as well as a growing prevalence, number of people living with the diseases all over the world. Whether you look at pediatric IBD, which is rising in most studies that have looked at this, or you look at the adult onset IBD or the adult diagnosed IBD, you can see it going up everywhere. Now, there are a number of reasons for this. We certainly have a number of studies of urbanization that suggests that the more urbanized people are, the more likely they are to have inflammatory bowel disease. A really nice study in India that went literally door to door in rural districts in India was able to characterize the prevalence of inflammatory bowel disease in places where we thought it didn't happen. And the reasons for it were at least associated with the urbanization, indoor plumbing, or access to vaccinations and antibiotics, or specific dietary strategies and habits. There are a variety of different things that I'm sure everyone listening has some ideas about, but we're starting to get better ideas that this is being driven, in fact, by changes in our food chain, changes in the environment becoming too clean or too contaminated, depending on which side of the coin you're studying. The other reason we're seeing more IBD around the world is that, thankfully, people don't die from these conditions. And you see a rising prevalence because once you're diagnosed, usually at a younger age, you have the disease your entire life. Hopefully, it's managed, but that's part of this. There's also the recognition and establishment now of what we call older onset or elderly onset, excuse the expression, IBD, so people who are over 50 or 60 developing new IBD, or maybe just getting diagnosed with IBD that's been there for 40 years, but very mild and progressed. So you can look at different reasons that we're seeing IBD all over the world go up, But the bottom line is that it is. And of course, it's expensive. And there's a lot of reasons that we should be studying it and working hard to figure it out.
Today's episode is made possible by Metro Infusion Centers. Metro Infusion Centers, with over 220 infusion centers nationwide, providing trusted and life-saving therapies to patients for over 30 years in a comfortable and cost-effective environment.
The third challenge of 10 is that there remains a large gap in effective therapies. What we call primary response and success, meaning the treatment works, and secondary loss of response or secondary non-response, where the therapy is working, but then it stops working. And this has been well described in our field for many years. The good news is that we've made some progress. We have newer therapies with new mechanisms. That could be an entire series of podcasts. But we also have learned that when we treat people with any of these therapies, if we achieve deeper levels of control, the bowel is healed, the labs are normal. There are different markers that we now know represent not just that the patient has improvement in symptoms, which is absolutely necessary, but that we're modifying the disease process, which results in less loss of response over time. And there is the development of novel combination strategies. We're now learning, not surprisingly, that when we combine some of our new techniques and new treatment options, we can gain much better control. And that does include early access to surgery in some people. So for someone newly diagnosed with Crohn's, we sometimes now consider surgery, not because they're obstructed or have an infectious complication, but actually to gain control of what has already been causing damage for some period of time before the diagnosis, and then to focus on prevention of it returning, which is a very successful strategy in most people. So lots of new ways to approach this, but the gaps remain, and we have to continue putting the pressure on to identify new mechanisms of action, looking at improvement of our existing mechanisms so that treatments are actually used to achieve disease modification and not just response with symptom improvement, and monitoring of the disease, which means not waiting for complications or for people to feel terrible, but rather being proactive in monitoring the disease. And of course, there are other podcasts in this series where we've talked about some of those advances, including bedside intestinal ultrasound. But there are many other tools in our tool belt now that can help us monitor the disease, and good research that we're doing and that the GI Research Foundation has funded, looking at biosensors and wearables and novel ways to predict inflammation before you even feel it. So we have a lot of work to do, but we're making some exciting progress across all fronts here. The fourth challenge of 10 is that there is a large disconnect between our patients and clinicians in the way we communicate. We've seen this for many years now in surveys that we've performed and interviews we've done with patients. And often what patients are thinking their goals should be, or their preferences about those goals, are distinctly different than what the clinicians who take care of them are thinking they should be. This is quite important, and it's a disconnect that we need to bridge. So for example, I just went through why we're not achieving all the goals we want in therapies. Part of that also is because we don't take the time to explain to people living with inflammatory bowel disease that we want them to be in remission and what remission is actually supposed to be. It's supposed to be the absence of symptoms, the modification of the disease process, controlling the inflammation, and returning to an unencumbered high quality of life, which means full functioning. And it includes a holistic approach to this. That means making sure the joints are okay, the skin is okay, that mental health is being addressed. All of these things have to be included in our management of patients and discussion with them of what we're trying to accomplish. And similarly, the patients need to feel comfortable and confident that we're able to get there and that they can communicate with us. That remains a big challenge, and one that I think education and ongoing communication and even this podcast can help us bridge. So raising expectations and getting everyone on the same page is really important.
Before we wrap up this episode with challenge number 5, we'd love to hear from you. Visit the GI Research Foundation website at giresearchfoundation.org and click on Share My Story right on the homepage. We're collecting stories from patients about positive communication experiences with their care teams. In early 2026, we'll be featuring some of these stories to highlight how strong patient-provider communication can lead to better disease management. Your story might be just the inspiration or practical tip that another patient needs. Now, back to Dr. Rubin.
The fifth challenge of 10 is that IBD management has become too complicated. Now, in some ways, you might say that's a good thing. It means we're teasing things apart. We have more options than ever before. But the reality is that more and more therapies have been approved by regulatory agencies here in the US. That's the FDA. In Europe, it's the EMA, and every other part of the world has their own regulatory agencies. But that doesn't mean that it makes sense where new treatments should go or how we should apply them or use them in patients. Regulatory agencies provide guidance really for industry and provide labels related to first safety and then secondarily the effectiveness of therapies. But we should recognize that as new therapies keep coming, and I'm sure many of you have seen the commercials on TV and the direct consumer advertising, it's not entirely clear which treatment we should use first, which treatment we should use if that's not working, how we optimize individual therapies, and when we should combine therapies. It's become too complicated. And I accept responsibility for that, as I have encouraged my colleagues to. We need to work on ways to simplify. One of the ways that we have encouraged people to think about this is using a treat-to-target strategy. Treating to a target means that we agree that we want patients to feel better quickly, and that we have specific targets of disease management that we're trying to accomplish in order to achieve longer-term disease control. And what's inherent in the treat-to-target strategy is an assessment of the disease activity serially over short periods of time to reassess how people are doing and to adjust the therapy, add a second treatment, or switch course completely as we're going through all this. And it's a very important idea. It requires operational aspects of it in your own practice as a clinician or for patients to understand what we're trying to do. And it also requires recognition that the targets we're trying to achieve actually end up being somewhat individualized based on the patient. Where is your disease? What is a marker of your activity that we can rely on and that we're trying to control? Not everybody has the same biomarkers of inflammation or the same manifestations of their disease. So for different people, we have different targets. Now, getting back to the International Organization for the Study of IBD, they have led the world in defining some of these targets in a consensus statement that's called STRIDE. And STRIDE 2 was published a few years ago. And right now, the group is working on STRIDE 3. And what we expect is that STRIDE 3 will move the field forward and help people understand, including patients, of course, what we're trying to achieve so that we can get there with more of our therapies.
Thank you so much, Dr. Rubin, for sharing your valuable time with us. And all of these insights are so important for anyone who is living with IBD or studying it or hoping to make a difference in the lives of those who are living with Crohn's disease and ulcerative colitis in 2025. We are so grateful. Thank you. Thank you for listening to this episode of the podcast Visceral from the GI Research Foundation. This episode was written, edited, and produced by me, Anna Gomberg, and edited and mixed by Luke Pahalski. Special thanks to the talented Michael Collins Dowden, who composed our theme music, and executive producer Allison Thielen. We hope you will join us next time, and until then, to access other podcasts and learn more about research to treat, prevent, and cure digestive diseases, please visit the website at giresearchfoundation.org. Please like and subscribe to Visceral on all your favorite podcast platforms. And until next time, listen to your gut. Thank you again to our sponsors, Metro Infusion Centers.
Subscribe to Visceral and join us next month for part 2 of the top 10 challenges in IBD care, covering challenges 6 to 10, including a can't-miss discussion on disease prevention. See you then.